before, if you wanted to extract the productive work, the productive energy from another human being, you had to physically dominate them, you know? Like, that's what slavery was for all of human history. You just physically dominated the other person. You literally chained them to the plow and had them drive forward. You're forcing them to, you know, arrange the material world in a way that benefits you. Like, well, we don't do that anymore, right? We don't do physical domination because it's really hard to scale. When you try to scale how much control you have over people physically, it's like, well, it takes a lot of infrastructure. And it's hazardous and it's not very efficient. Well, today we achieve those same exact ends of extracting all the productive work and energy from people through the printing of the money. You know, so it's like before they had to stab people, today they just slowly poison you. It's like it's still the same crime and it's formal slavery.
Hello guys, welcome once again to BitCorner Podcast. I hope that you have enjoyed the three-part series, let's say, of different podcasters that we have had in the show. As I told you, without planning it, we had three generations in the past episodes, all podcasters. So we have Bob Burnett, we have Bram, we have Nikki. So Bob is a boomer, Bram is a millennial, Nikki is a Gen Z. And they all shared their perspective and how Bitcoin is helping to each generation. What are the things that we're facing the most? I'm millennial, so I kind of related to Bram, but also I have seen the struggles that my parents have. So everything that Bob shared, I completely agree with him. And yeah, it's beautiful to see that it doesn't matter our age or generation, Bitcoin is always provide a solution to a broken system. So today we want to go deeper. I always like to invite authors of books that have written, they have done research about the broken system and the new system and how can Bitcoin can be a solution. But of course, to talk about the solution, I think we need to talk even more about the problem, because that's the thing that we need to be more aware of. People often doesn't ask what money is, what money actually is. And I think that's something that we need to go further, because that's just the first question that we need to do to go into this madness of rabbit hole. So I don't want to extend any longer. Today, I want to welcome Neil Fleischer. So I want to start saying a little bit about your book. It's quite amazing. As I told you before starting the podcast, it was great to hear that you have been in the show with Dan Prince. Actually, I want to shout out Dan Prince because of him. I know about you, but your book is really amazing, Modern Chain. So welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Juan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks to you. So I want to start actually with, because I think we're going to talk a lot. So let's go right to the point. If you had 60 seconds to explain Modern Chains to someone who has never heard of you, how will you state your thesis as simply and bluntly as possible? What is modern slavery and what does money have to do with it?
Yeah, so the book in 60 seconds is just the moral analysis of the monetary system. Now, I'm a philosopher. I studied, Aristotle and Aquinas. And as a new person coming into this space, in the Bitcoin space, that's how I approached, the whole topic of what is money and what's happening with debasement and all that. So I just, it's my attempt to, in the most accessible terms possible, just lay out the philosophical underpinnings of the ethical implications of our monetary system and then just follow it where it leads. Like you said before, that what is money question, it's really important. And as a new person coming into the Bitcoin space, all anybody ever talks about is money, but it's almost always through this economic lens. And, it's just, it kind of struck me as an outsider that that's kind of odd, because so economics is like a descriptive, kind of science, if you want to call it a science. It describes, you look at a chart, it's like, these are the prices that happened. It's looking backwards at showing what occurred. I think one of the problems that we have when we try to orange pill people and we talk about Bitcoin is we're trying to sell them an ought. Hey, Bitcoin is good for you. You should use Bitcoin. Like, we're trying to sell them a prescription. But when we use economics, where we're describing what has happened, like, that's the wrong tool for the job. know, so as a philosopher, like I study ethics. Ethics is like the domain of the ought, of the prescription. That's the right tool. The analogy I kind of think about it is like, you know, economics is a surface level tool. You know, it's like a rake. If you need to clear some stuff off, like it's useful, it has a function and it's really good at its function. But if you're trying to dig and get at the roots of a problem, you're gonna take a long time and it's gonna be painful trying to dig a hole with a rake. It's like you need to just put the rake down and pick up a shovel so you can actually work efficiently and get somewhere. That's my contribution to the Bitcoin community, is just like I'm trying to raise awareness that, like, I know people love talking about the economics. We love talking about price. We love talking about trades and levered longs and all this like stuff. Like, but it's not the right tool when we're trying to advocate Bitcoin, when we're trying to go to a no coiner, you know, our loved ones, our neighbors that don't understand Bitcoin. And when we just start spitting a bunch of macro at them, it doesn't shock me that they don't get it. Like the adoption rate doesn't really surprise me when it's like, well, of course we're using the wrong tool. It works for some people. Some people are just like economically, like that's just how they think and see the whole world. So, I mean, I don't care how you get Bitcoin as long as you get it. But, you know, as evidenced by like so many people not getting it, it's like perhaps, you know, we should rethink our strategy for how we talk about Bitcoin, how we talk about the monetary system. You know, I'm not here to make fiat dollars, you know, like I don't want Bitcoin to rise up, you know, in fiat price. Like that means nothing to me. You know, it's I don't know. Sorry, I'm just kind of rambling here, but
no, but I get you 100%. One thing that I'm really curious is that you mentioned that you study philosophy and ethics, and also you mentioned Aristotle's. Somehow this reading the School of Philosophy helped you to understand all of this, the broken system?
Yeah, I mean, so one of my issues, like I understand why people love using that word broken, but you know, when we think broken, we're thinking some type of function, like a tool is not capable of like achieving its end, you know, like the shovel, if it's snapped in half, like I can't dig with it anymore. It's a broken tool. And like when we ask that question of, well, what is money? Right. Mm-hmm. So this goes back to Aristotle.
Okay.
Aristotle understood that money is moral, meaning that it's like a relation between people. It's how we relate to each other. So if we just think about like, okay, so what is even, how does money come into be? Like how is money created? It's like, well, people create money. If there were no people on the earth, there's not like money. There'd still be gold. There'd still be rocks and seashells and all like jewels and stuff. But like they're just objects. It takes a person picking it up and like trading, exchanging with other people. So it's like, you know, Aristotle identified that the exchange of money is like that's the essence of money. Like two people exchanging value. So it's like, I mean, that's 2,000 years ago. You know, like this is. He recognized that, hey, money is this tool and it's moral inherently. There's no neutrality with money. It's like it's a tool that communicates value, and it either communicates with fidelity, like honestly, like it truthfully, or it communicates that in a distorted, noisy, like a disruptive way. And it's like, okay, so we have this tool that enables us to communicate value between people. And we take it one step further and say, okay, well, you and I actually don't need money. Like if we live together and we know each other, like we don't need money to work together. We don't need money to operate together, to cooperate. You know, like if you have children or a wife or, you know, your parents, you know, growing up, you didn't like the children don't need money to relate with their parents. You know, they're communicating value and communicate, they relate differently, but they don't actually need the money. Like you can even think about like a tribe. Like if you know everybody in your tribe, you know them intimately, you know exactly what they're doing, and you're all like this kind of socialist, you know, community, like that can work at that like small tribal level because everybody can know each individual person. But the thing that money does is it lets that scale, that those relationships, it lets them scale, you know? So it's like the thing that money does, you could think of it as it's the tool that literally creates society. You do not get a society without money. Money is the technology that lets civilization rise, right? And again, this is going back, you know, to Aristotle, building off these, like, these are not new ideas. These are just kind of old ideas that people just kind of brushed off and like forgot about. But it's like, money is this moral tool. Money is this tool that literally creates civilization, and it lets people communicate value in an app, like a stranger. I don't know you. You could just be an AI image. I don't know. But like, if you give me money, it's like, that's this abstracted kind of trust in that sense, like exchange goods for services with somebody I don't know. But because we're using money, it works. You know, it's like, that's the killer app or the key feature of what money does. So going back to this idea of broken money, mm-hmm. creates the relationships of a civilization, right? Mm-hmm. We have relationships, you know, like in this fiat world. Like, so mm-hmm. it's, in a sense, it is functioning perfectly well, but it's doing its literal job. It's not broken in that sense. Like, it's creating how we relate to each other, but it's doing it in a, like an extractive, controlling way.
Okay.
The point is evil, not broken. When we think broken, we're like, oh, well, we can fix it. And we hear that term, fix the money, fix the world. And it's like, mm-hmm. it's true. If you think about fix, like nailing it to the wall, immutable, 21 million hard cap, you know, like that's the, like, cause fix has that like double meaning, you know, like I fix my broken car or I fix the, you know, the poster to the wall, you know, like if you fix the money in that sense where you nail it down, you don't let it change. It's, you know, it's a measure and it doesn't change. That's the term that we say fix is like, in its proper term. But if we say fix like repair, well, that gets it completely wrong. Like when you understand that moral nature, it's how we relate. It's it lets you identify the root of what's actually happening. Like if you see this weed growing up and you're looking at the petals and you're looking at the leaves, like, well, you can pluck them off all day. You know, you need to get at the root of the problem. And the root problem is that the money is dishonest. The money is evil. The money is extractive. So it's Bitcoin. The reason Bitcoin performs the way it does is because of its ethical roots. You know, yeah. That's Aristotle. He says literally that, you know, economics grows out of the ethics. So without that ethical foundation, you don't have an economy. You don't have anything else. So it's the economic fruit is a product of the ethics. And we have lousy economic fruit today because we have literally an evil root. It's like the evil ethics. It's wrong. So when you put it like that, you know, I'm not trying to convince you to invest in Bitcoin, get a whole bunch more dollars and it's going to grow and da 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 da. You know, it's like, no, you buy Bitcoin, you save Bitcoin, you spend and earn in Bitcoin, you go to a Bitcoin standard, you opt out of fiat to Bitcoin because it's moral. Because it takes you out of that control system and lets you be free, lets you be a sovereign, lets you be a human. As a human being, you're a rational agent and you have dignity and free will in that controlling extractive system. It degrades you. So it's just kind of that case, speaking in those terms, the moral case, I think, is just so much easier for a person to recognize when you can show them this system literally aggresses upon you. It attacks you. It degrades your very humanity and just opt out. They're like, that's what's so beautiful about Bitcoin. Like before Bitcoin, you didn't have a tool, you know, like, what do you do? I don't know. Maybe I'll get some gold, all this, like but you still are playing in that kind of fiat world. But we finally have a tool to just opt out, you know, to just step aside and just leave fiat behind. Like you don't need the politicians. Like it's great that your country is actually trying to integrate that in the politics. But like for just a normal person like me, like I don't need to wait around for the president or Congress or anything, you know, to free myself. I can just adopt the Bitcoin standard and it liberates you and it's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I want to also talk a little bit more about this because I just said, yeah, just in my country, it's doing it, but I'm just playing here as the devil advocate. So people that are learning about this, right? So about Bitcoin and the fiat system. So one thing that I want to ask you is that if you can explain a little bit through the mechanism of how does fiat money works and at what exact point in that process of the existence of it do you think the moral crime occurs in the system?
Cuando dejas tus activos digitales en un exchange o en custodia de alguien más, te expones a riesgos de terceros no deseados. A diferencia del sistema bancario tradicional, Bitcoin te permite tomar el control total de tus fondos utilizando tus propias claves privadas. Esto te permite ser soberano y esencialmente tu propio banco. Al tomar el control de tus Bitcoins, puedes evitar riesgos innecesarios de terceros. Almacenar tus Bitcoin en custodia de terceros como los exchanges puede exponerte a ataques de actores malintencionados, gobiernos o estafadores que lo único que quieren es apoderarse de tu dinero. Las billeteras de hardware aumentan la seguridad de tu billetera porque tus claves privadas se almacenan en un dispositivo especializado que no está siempre conectado al internet. Como te he dicho antes, mantener tus claves almacenadas en un dispositivo en línea puede exponerte a factores adicionales de ataque, por lo que se recomienda usar una billetera de hardware al almacenar grandes cantidades de Bitcoin durante largos periodos de tiempo. Jade es una billetera de hardware no custodial para Bitcoins y Liquid que ofrece opciones de firma simple y firmas múltiples. Yo personalmente lo utilizo para almacenar mis bitcoins, ya que me siento mucho más seguro manteniendo mis bitcoins en una billetera fría que en una almacenada, por ejemplo, en mi teléfono. Si estás pensando en adquirir uno para ti, no olvides utilizar el código de descuento de nuestro show, BitCornerPodcast. De esta forma estarás apoyando directamente el show y además obtendrás un 10% de descuento para la compra de tu billetera fría.
So the more there's two main functions or mechanisms for how our current fiat monetary system is evil. So it's through debasement and usury. The debasement mm-hmm. is when they talk about printing money. Like that's really what debasement is. Debasement is when you know all the value. So like if you think like value is a real thing. There's, you know, when you talk about all the economists talking about value, like there's on the two sides, you basically have this like objective theory of value, which is like Karl Marx, where it's just like, well, value is the total sum, the quantity of the effort and labor put into a product. And, you know, it's like, that's wrong for a lot of reasons. But there's one thing that it gets right in that sense is that, well, like it has to be real. It has to, like, when you create something, you create it in reality. Like there's an object, like you are moving an object to do so. Like I have to plant the seed. I have to water it. It has to grow and create fruit. You know, like that fruit is a real thing. It's an object. Like, it's not in my head. You know, when I create value, I'm creating fruit. I'm organizing the material world in such a way to achieve my purpose, my end, like my goals. So the sliver of truth that Marx gets right is that there's this tether to reality with how we organize the material world, you know, and that's, but most of it's completely wrong. He only has that tiny little tether that's correct. You know, all the Austrians and Mises, they talk about the subjective theory of value. And that's a huge correction against Marx, you know? So it's like, if we think about, we're trying to fly a heading, we're trying to stay true north and we're weaving in and out, like Marx is off over here and we make a correction to go back, you know, we're like, hey, this is, we're trying to get here. Let's go back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that correction, it helps us until it becomes an overcorrection. And if we mm-hmm. take it too far and we forget about that tether, the true part that Marx got right, well, now we're actually going away from, we just made a mistake in the opposite direction. So that mm-hmm. idea that value is just your preference, value is just in your mind, it has nothing to do with the object, that is a step too far. So it's okay. It's taking both of those and saying, okay, well, where are they converted? We have this tether to reality. There's some connection to the objective world. We have to incorporate that in with the preferences. And the preference comes from, well, what is your end? What are you trying to do? What's your goal? What's your aim? And you merge, you unify both of those together. And like, that's what real value is. Like, value in reality. You put in motion, like you expend energy with your work, your sweat, your, you know, whatever. You expend energy to rearrange the material world to move it towards your preferred end state. Like yeah. That's kind of the phenomenon that what we would say, that's how we create value in the world. It's like, okay, well, how does Bitcoin mimic the reality of value? It expends energy. There's a real cost to expend energy, to rearrange the material world. Like, even though it's electrons, it's like they're just as material as, you know, anything else. Like, they're particles, you know, it's physics.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's rearranging the physical world to order it in such a way that it moves us towards our end, which is having an immutable, secure ledger of account of what was done, what work was done. That's what another way of thinking kind of what money represents. It says, this work was done. It represents it in reality. You can trust it is true. It's like a true account of what happened. And when you exchange that value for value, I'm creating value over here, which some people want. You don't want that, but you created value in some other way. And then that touch point of where our value is actually, I need what you want and you want what I have. It's like, well, yeah, that's where that exchange happens. But it's just like, but it's real. There's value on both sides of the equation. And the thing with fiat, it just completely steps outside of reality. Like, there's nothing about printing dollars from nothing that is requires work expenditure. Like, it can just be made up or changed or any, like, there's nothing immutable. There's nothing real in it. So it's like, but what's funny is, like, if you live in a completely subjective world where value is whatever you think it is or say it is, well, then fiat kind of actually makes sense. It doesn't matter if they're just making it up because we're all going along with it. So what's the harm? It's just kind of like well, there is a harm because it opens up this huge window of corruptibility. We're human beings and we're fallible. Like, this goes back to Plato, you know, and in the Republic, he's arguing, you know, about what is justice. And, you know, he's talking with Thrasymachus and, you know, what, and he's like, well, what's justice? It's like, well, whatever advantages the stronger, like, might makes right. You know, I'm bigger, I'm stronger, I can push you down. So you just have to go along with it. You know, like, we reject that, like, back in Plato, like, that argument is so pitiful. Like, it crumbles. Like, Plato dismantles it, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. But yet we find ourselves in this, like, system where we want to just believe that, where we want to go along with it. It's like, oh, well, the big bad government says I have to do this, so I guess that makes right. It's like, no, they're still wrong. No matter how big and strong they are, like, you can't just, like, I don't know. I'm just a realist. I believe in reality. Like, we share an existence in one reality. And, like, I don't know, we have to mediate those relations, you know? And I will not play the stupid game of, like, just pretending to go along with fantasy land. Like, it's just not, it's not okay that one person gets just to say, I'm going to print money and you have to deal with it. Like, I think when you frame it in those kind of, in that kind of light, I think it's a lot easier to reach people, because my whole thing is, like, justify debasement. You politician, tell me why you get to print money. And if you just tell me because might makes right, like, that's completely dumb. The short answer is there's actually no answer to that. There's no legitimate answer to why do you get to print money? You know, like, morally, like, if you live in just a completely amoral, if you pretend it's an amoral world where might makes right, then sure, that's your justification. But then I'm going to fight you on that front. But so when you ask a person, though, hey, why do you go along with this? Why do you allow them to print the money? Like, that's kind of the question that I think can touch a person that isn't thinking about it, you know, because it's just like, well, hey, yeah, why do they get to print money? And I am going along with it. I'm enabling that. I'm voting for it. I'm playing along. I'm spending fiat. I'm earning fiat. I'm paying all my taxes in fiat. It's like, well, maybe I shouldn't be in that system. Like, I can do something about that now. So why don't I do that? So that's kind of like the whole debasement thing. Like, they print money and it costs nothing. It can be manipulated. It's a completely subjective world. And that's just not real. Pure subjectivism is not real. I deal in reality where it's this both thing. Like, I'm a subject. I have a subjective consciousness. I have a human experience that's just mine. It's my own. I'm unique in that sense. But I am also, I have a body. I exist in reality. I can hit this table and, you know, it's just like, there's one world, we're all in it. You know, I didn't pick to be here. You know, I didn't choose to, like, you and I are relating voluntarily now. you asked me to come and I said, yeah, hey, we'll meet up, let's talk. But like, I didn't ask you if you could exist and you didn't ask me if I could exist, but we still do. So it's like, that's kind of the human problem, is mediating these non-voluntary relationships. You know, I don't get to choose my family. I don't get to choose my nation. I don't get to choose any of these things, that like the circumstances that I'm born into, but like, we're all in that. And we have to mediate that. And like, we're not all the same powerful. Like the baby is not as powerful as the parents. Like the huge state is not as is more powerful than just the one little individual person. So it's like, there's a lot of tension in reality, and people get uncomfortable with that. And that's why they want to retreat to like fantasy lands where they can just make clear cut, nice, easy, like, this is just the way the world is in my head. And I'm just going to just live with it. But it's like, you're not living in reality. I reject all those type of fantasies. I want to live in reality because I want to navigate through it so I can get to where I want to go. Sorry, I'm just kind of, but that's like the whole debate.
No, it's perfect.
Bitcoin and fiat, they're like inverted images of each of themselves, you know? And like, that's, again, people talk about evil as the inversion of the good. It's like, well, yeah, we have this evil system, this evil fiat system. And when you invert it, you get Bitcoin. Like, you have a morally upright, honest money. And when people can communicate honestly, you know, that's what lets you plan and save. And like, it's no coincidence. You know, people often cite, well, every civilization that purposely debases their money collapses. That is not an accident. You know, like, the money is the thing that keeps the civilization upright and together. So when you debase it and you flip the relation on its head, it can do nothing but fall apart. That's kind of the debasement side. The usury side is like a little bit more technical when you get into the mechanics of the monetary system. And like, okay, fiat is a debt-based money and it's created. You know, we asked, how do you create value earlier? How do you create money? People exchanging. Well, when you ask, well, how is fiat created? Well, someone just says there's money. They print it and it gets injected into the system through loans. So it's like the central bank loans it out to the commercial banks. Just
the functional bank.
Of debt. The central bank, the top spigot, the printer, lends it out, and then it just keeps getting lent out and lent out and lent out until it reaches, you know, normal people. It's like usury is like this idea of, so people often get it mistaken when they say, oh, well, usury is tied to the interest rate. It's giving a loan at a high interest rate. It has nothing to do with the interest rate. It's all about whether or not it's tethered, whether it's real, tethered to reality. If I loan you something real, you know, real money, it can be justified if I can lose. I have to, like, the work, and when we talked about you have to contribute some work. Well, the work of the lender is bearing risk, which is real. That's a legitimate thing. Like, if I have 100,000, you know, Bitcoin, and I want to lend it to somebody, they have it. There's no like, there's no getting it back. There's no hitting an undo button if they squander it. You know, if they buy a farm and they plant a bunch of crops and the crops all fail, well, they lost and I lost. Like, that's the real risk. Like, hey, will this endeavor fail or will this succeed? You know, and you as a lender have to manage and mitigate that risk. So it's like, if you're bearing that risk, then you can say that it doesn't matter what the interest rate is. If you and I both agreed to 70% interest because you needed the money that bad, but you can make it, like, you can afford that interest rate, if you want to pay that, like, there's no moral objection to that. Mm-hmm. But if I'm lending you fiat and the crops fail, but then the central bank can just, it's okay, there's no actual risk there. So when you're lending money with no risk, that is usury. Like, that's like the main principle when you're trying to think about what usury is. So it's just like, that's our entire system. Our entire system can be papered over. When they let a bank fail, that's a policy choice. They could have saved it. Like, that's the weird thing. Like, they can literally save any bad business endeavor. And it's just kind of like we get those big bank bailouts, like the big headlines where they're like, oh, we had to come save all the banks or the entire system would collapse. They're too big to fail. It's like, well, that's when you had to do it. But you could literally do that all the time. It's just kind of like it's like almost like they know that if they did it all the time, people would catch on. So they try to only do it like intermittently. It's like, oh, this is just an emergency. It's like, it's not an emergency. That's literally the entire system.
Chris.
So it's like, that's why. That the other sense, like, it's evil because it's usurious. Like the way that the money is created is just one big usury scheme. And it's just like, I'm not going to play along with it anymore. Opt out.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if that answered your question. Those are the two, the kind of the twin pillars of enslavement. Like, because both of those mechanisms, when you think about what's happening, like each, they hit the print button for each, mm-hmm. each time. Each side of that. And what does that happen? We said, okay, so value is real. You create real value and you're storing it in a monetary object. And when you store the value you create in a dollar, they're all hooked up, you know, to the total money supply. So when they're printing money, since we treat every dollar as fungible, like $1 is $1, we treat it, it's not correct, but we mm-hmm. treat it as such when we say they're fungible. So when they're creating new dollars and injecting those into the monetary supply, there's no more value created. So it siphons out the value created. And that's what they're talking about, purchasing power. When they say, oh, well, my dollar doesn't stretch as far. Well, that's because the real value that was in that dollar got siphoned out. It got extracted. And that's getting back to the book and like the thing that like really, yeah. When I connected that in my mind, like I could not no longer see that, because that's the formal definition of slavery. This, if you want to think of it as like, so murder is another, moral crime. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if I shoot you with a gun or I stab you with a knife or I poison your food. Like, I'm murdering you, mm-hmm. even though I used a different tool. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that's the material that I'm using to achieve that end of killing you. And it's like, okay, well, you know, before, if you wanted to extract the productive work, the productive energy from another human being, you had to physically dominate them. You know, like that's what slavery was for all of human history. You just physically mm-hmm. dominated the other person. You literally chained them to the plow and had them drive forward. You're forcing them to, you know, arrange the material world in a way that benefits you. Like, well, we don't do that anymore, right? We don't do physical domination because it's really hard to scale. When you try to scale how much control you have over people physically, it's like, well, it takes a lot of infrastructure and it's hazardous and it's not very efficient. Well, today we achieve those same exact ends of extracting all the productive work and energy from people through the printing of the money, you know? So it's like, before they had to stab people, today they just slowly poison you. It's like, it's still the same crime and it's formal slavery. So it's like, mm-hmm. when you come at it from this moral angle and you're thinking about, you know, hey, money is moral. Money creates civilization. It creates how we relate to each other. Fiat makes us relate to each other in a literal slavery, a way that they extract all that productive energy from you. It's like, I don't know. It clicks and like it hit me so hard that it's like, this is it. Like, this is my fight. I am not going to let, you know, I'm not going to pass this mess. Like, there's a mess on aisle 7 and I'm not going to pass it on to my children. I'm not going to let them kick the can to them and say, you fix it. You clean it up or you deal with it. Like, this can was kicked to me. I'm not like speaking down to anybody too. Like, I spent my entire life just, you know, going along with it because I didn't care. Like, I don't know. I didn't think I could do anything. I didn't know, you know, there was just so much stuff. Like, I was just going along with this. And it's just like, you know, at some point in your life, you know, you realize, hey, what am I doing with my life? What am I doing? And it's just like, I have things I care about. I have things that I want to give my children, a much better life than I did. And it's just like, I don't see any other way, or I guess I don't see any other thing I could do for them that could be more beneficial than literally trying to kill fiat, get people to abandon, just get off of it. But I'm trying to, like, that's why I've dedicated myself now to, like, I'm in the Bitcoin space. I'm trying to be a leader. I'm trying to talk. I'm trying to advocate for Bitcoin, help us rally the pitchforks so we can just put an end to this. It's like, now that we have this tool, now that we have Bitcoin, it's like, it would just be such a shame to not use it. Like, a lot of your listeners, but like, just think about Ron Paul. You know, he's like, I don't know, like 95 years old. He's been fighting against the central bank and fiat for his entire life. And he didn't have Bitcoin. He didn't have a tool to like actually take it to them. So it's just like, what would he have done if he had Bitcoin when he was 30? You know, like if Bitcoin was here 60 years ago, what would he have done? He probably would have picked it up and used it. And it's like, you know, that's kind of my like, this is a monetary arm. You know, like we don't need guns for this revolution. You know, we just how you spend money, how you relate to other people. Like that's the, I guess, use the tool that they've weaponized against us. It's like, well, you flip it back on them.
No, but I get you, because I was thinking about several things that you said. First, I think if you think deeper, that's the real reason why we try to implement Bitcoin in our country. And I'm not talking about people like me, people, because yes, luckily, even if I live in El Salvador, yes, I was raised in a bubble, right? But the reality of the poverty, it's outside the city in the rural areas. So I think that's why, like in places like El Sante, that when we started, it was so poor, it has evolved into what it is right now. That is what people know it famously. But it's not because Bitcoin has gained value, which is, yes, in some part, yes, of course, that helps economically speaking. But I think that the purpose behind it is that even if it was the grassroots efforts of the government, doesn't matter where it comes from, but I think the idea behind it is to provide a tool to the people that can have access to a fair system, right? That they can compete to each other, they can provide value to each other, and they can now extract it, that time that they put or their effort and whatever they do into the fiat system. Because as you explained, that's the new modern slavery, because they're losing value every single time. They're printing money and they're losing probably all the efforts that you do. So I think it's really important to understand that we're just not teaching people to use Bitcoin just because. It's not. It's like to provide you a real system, right, where you can work.
And what you're talking about is even more so, like the social capital. Again, mm-hmm. How you relate to other people. When you can relate honestly, when you can relate to other people in a cooperatively, cooperation will always have an asymmetrical advantage over extraction. When they talk about mm-hmm. creating abundance, what does that even mean, like in reality? It's like the world has more of its physical, most of the material reality is organized as such that it has made more value for people. Like it lets people do more things that they want to do because of how the material world is arranged. And when people are cooperating, they create more value. But when you're mm-hmm. in an extractive system, creating value is punished. You know, like follow the incentives. When you punish the creation of value, people don't create value. But when mm-hmm. you you can create value and keep that value. You know, you are entitled to the fruit of your labor. When you get to keep the fruit that you create, like you want to create more, and you work with other people better. And it's like, it's also like these social issues too. Like we have a system where, you know, I talk about this a little bit, where it's just like you go from a, you know, 50 years ago or whatever, and like the single, mm-hmm. the single income could provide for a whole house.
Yeah.
One parent could work and they could actually survive off that and thrive and save. Today, both parents are working multiple jobs. Everybody's working themselves to the bone and they can barely keep up. And it's like, well, why is that? Well, we severed that connection with fiat in 71. We completely severed that connection from the creation of value and money. The money is created not by creating more value. The money is created just through clicking the button and printing mm-hmm. it. And it's like when you sever that, it's like people respond to the, like if those are the rules of the game, well, people are going to play by those rules. So that's why everybody wants to be in finance. Nobody wants to go just like build a business. Like, no, I got to go trade. I got to go speculate. I have to go win a zero sum game. That's the only way to gain wealth today. You know, like gain wealth in this system. And it's like, well, if everybody's playing a zero sum game, you know, the pie is not getting any bigger. You know, we're just redistributing it. It's like, that's kind of one of the things that I think is funny. Like all these, a lot of the capitalist type people that, you know, say, hey, socialist redistribution is so horrible, but yet they're the financiers that are playing the Wall Street games. And that's just, that's redistribution as well. So it's like, you know, you it's not that, it's not a left or right type of thing. It's like all redistribution is bad. I don't care about redistribution. I want people creating new things, creating more value in the world. That's how you make abundance. You know, it's like people have been going in the back alleys and rolling dice, you know, for all of human history. You know, it's like, that's not going to go away, but it's just like, I just wish we could speak honestly about that. Like when you're going and trading on Wall Street, I'm levered long here, I'm taking the short there. Like all these derivative products, like these are just trading games, and it's just exchanging, you know, value, money left and right. It's just changing hands. It's not making the world any richer, more abundant. It's not creating anything. But you go and invest in a business, you know, like a Shark Tank example. I have real capital. You have an idea. And we come together, whether I loan the money to you in a non-usurious loan or like I buy equity or whatever, like we come together to try to create something new. And when that succeeds, you know, those cooperative games are win-win, lose-lose. Like that's kind of how we want to be playing. These win-lose games are horrible. One of the stats I threw in the book I thought was funny, you know, I can't remember where I pulled the stat from. It was like the Bureau of Labor or whatever statistics. But like 95% of all businesses, startups in America fail in the first 5 years. And people say like, oh man, that's just really, really hard to start a business. I don't take it that. I don't read that those stats that way. I say 95% of those businesses were bad ideas and shouldn't have been funded. You know, like, but since we're in this world where you have to just speculate and win, and you're just printing money, but you're just throwing it at everything. It's like the way that you can gain is you invest a whole bunch in a startup, you know, 10 of them. And then a bunch of them are going to fail because they were stupid ideas run by stupid people that shouldn't have got the money, but you didn't do the due diligence to actually like, because you're playing wild, because that's that's what the incentives do it. But that one business hit, and then you sell it. You know, like you're not actually in the business for the product to create the bunny. You're trying to rug pull others. You know, you're putting, I'm buying 10 meme coins, and then the one meme coin that goes up, I get to rug everybody else out on that. And it's like, that offsets your losses from the other nine. It's like, that's actually more so the truth of what we're doing with businesses than, you know, actually like a Shark Tank investor. Like I'm going to, you know, bring my knowledge and expertise and network to try to make this thing happen. And it's just like, if you play fiat games, you get fiat, you know, rewards. And that's just kind of what we're doing. It's just like on all scales.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, you thought a point that I always like to present to people that ask me about Bitcoin, fiat, and crypto. And I think that's even nowadays, it's one of the main topics or things that people misunderstand, right? That people say that they're not in the system, that Bitcoin and crypto are the same thing. But actually, no, it's that cryptos and fiat work in the same system. It's not that crypto is going to be better or provide a solution to fiat, because it's exactly works. The mechanism of how it works is exactly the same thing. But the other way, Bitcoin, as you mentioned, works in the other way around, completely the opposite of how fiat works, right?
Yeah, that's a, you know, and the mechanism of that is like, so you say, well, what does Bitcoin solve? Like, what problem does it solve? And it solves the trust problem. Right now, I trust the government and the Federal Reserve not to print all the money in the world. Like I'm trusting them to do it at a, you know, a rate that doesn't just completely destroy me, right? But it's like, or you could even say, if we had a system that we had a fiat system, but they said they wouldn't print, you know, they said, we're not going to debase the money. You're trusting them not to, right? They continually prove through their actions that they will print the money. But that's what I'm saying. It's all on trust. And it's like, well, what do you get from the crypto sphere? It's that exact, like you said, it's the exact same game. You are trusting the founder, you're trusting the proof of stake, you're trust, like there's a lot of trust placed in something that is, that leaves you completely vulnerable. You know, it's like, where with Bitcoin, there is no trust.
It's verified.
Since it verifies everything, since all eyes see all things, and it's completely open, you're just running consensus code, you're like, all that is just, it solves, it just closes that window. So it's like, that's why it's solid. That's why it's different. And like, you want to say, oh, this crypto, if you think crypto and Bitcoin are the same, it's like, well, you don't get what Bitcoin solves, and you don't see the difference between them. It's like, one has zero trust, the others still have trust. And even if you want to say, oh, well, this is a really benevolent, you know, crypto founder, or this is a really benevolent Fed chair, it's like, I just don't care. I don't care. I just don't want to trust. I don't want to trust.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I also want to ask you about where we have been talking about the philosophical and ethical side of things, but I also know that you went to the military, and I want to ask you the point of view of some things. about this, but before I tell you that the podcast has a game. So my previous guest have a question for my next guest. So now is the time. So I'm gonna mix you the question.
Neil, I would love to ask you, because my podcast is focused on Gen Z, because I'm 20 years old myself, I would love to know how Bitcoin can be a solution to a lot of the problems that we're seeing in the world today that Gen Z cares about. So this could be war, wealth inequality, like any kind of discrimination or just the broader scheme of things. How is Bitcoin not only personally the best thing for us, but the best thing for us as kind of one human race, if that makes sense?
Yeah. So I would answer. So what does Bitcoin do for Gen Z specifically? So one of the things that I thought was just really crazy when I was doing the research for my book was that when you start pricing assets in the median hourly wage for a worker, right? That's kind of like the closest kind of proxy measurement you can get for like how much a person's work is, like an hour of their work is worth in terms of value, like real value, not just the nominal price. Basically, it doesn't matter what asset you measure in. If you measure from like 1971, to today, old houses, cars, like just about anything, it takes about seven to eight times as much hourly. You have to take the median hourly wage and you seven or eight X it, right? That's the difference. I guess a different way of putting it is like you have to work 7 to 8 hours today to what somebody in 1970 had to do for one. So, I know you're talking about the different generations. So it's like the boomers, to no fault of their own individually, when they were working, when they were 20, when they were in the same position that the Gen Z people are today, right? They could put themselves through school, sweeping up after class. They could go get a part-time job and put themselves through school because they were making eight times, like the value of that work was, their work was valued eight times more through what they were getting paid than today, right? That is a crazy thing. Like, so if you think about, I'm working and I can't get ahead, it's like, well, that's because you have to work an entire lifetime. What you can earn in your 20s, like I'm working whatever medium hourly wage job from 20 to 30, like, well, what the boomers made in their 20 to 30, it would take you 20 to 90, your entire life. So it's like, what does Bitcoin do? Well, it's circumvents, it says you don't have to play that game anymore. It says, hey, I'm going to work and I'm at least going to save it in something that, combats that. Like you're still not getting paid, what the boomer got in terms of real value, but at least you can at least do something with it. It's like they talk about the life raft or whatever off the sinking ship. It's just like by opting out, by moving to this, honest money system where you can relate truthfully and honestly with other people, it's like, you get to keep the value that you do earn. So it's like, that's kind of like the thing that I think is really important for the Gen Z people. Cause it's like, when you're looking at this, I can't work and get anywhere. And what I do earn just gets debased anyways. Like that breeds this nihilistic fatalism. Like you just think nothing's worth any, like it strips you of all the meaning of your life. And that's a horrible place to be. So it's like, well, by adopting Bitcoin standard, by leaving fiat, not so you get to keep the value, but you also get that's a more hopeful future. But you can build a world, you can help contribute and create a system. By getting people to adopt Bitcoin, we're recreating this fiat world. I want to be in a world where people are relating to each other honestly, where people are working and cooperating to create more value in the world. That's the world I want to be in. So it's like by having Bitcoin, you not only get to save your value, but you get to have hope that, that the future will be brighter than today. So it's like, I don't know if that's a good answer or not. I'm just trying to say hope. It gives you hope as a Gen Z person that you don't have to despair and just be nihilistic. And it also gives you a tool, a mechanism to actually save and keep the value that you create in the world.
And but as I told you, I also want to explore a little bit about the military side, because I heard other podcasts that you have been there, that you did the military. And I want to ask you, okay, I have had some conversations with some friends recently, also because of the war that are now currently in Europe. And I was trying to explain, in this case, through this perspective, about how the fiat system works, you know, in the weight of the forever wars and the military industrial complex. So first, I want to ask you if you can explain a little bit about that for people that are listening in the first time, for the first time, and how did the understanding the mechanism of fiat change your view on these topics?
Sure. So the principle of the monetary system is that when you have debt-based fiat money, there is a necessity to expand. If it doesn't inflate, it implodes. So when you understand that principle, like they always are going to have to print, they basically will always have to come up with some justification for why they're printing. That's why you get, oh, we have this emergency, or oh, we have this. Like, you need some pretense to justify to the people why they are printing the money, because you're trying to keep them, you know, just going along with it and being okay with the fact that they're literally debasing and taking and extracting from you everything that you've earned. And so when I was in the military, you know, we've fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Middle East for, you know, 20 plus years. And it's just like, mm-hmm. Throughout that entire time, it's always like, you have to kind of like, you have to wrestle with the fact that you're not winning, you know, like, hey, this is forever. This just keeps going on and on and on. Like, every time you think like, oh, well, this is what we got to do, and then it'll come to an end, because like, it's just like, it never does. It's always, you know, the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. It's like you're being strung along. And it's just like, I stopped thinking about it and like, wait a second, are we really just that bad that we can't win? Or is that not the point? Is winning not the point? And I don't think winning is the point anymore. Mm-hmm. Now that I know what I know about the monetary system and how the government has to inject the money, it's if the government just prints all the money in the world and it just sits, you know, in Washington, it doesn't really do anything. They have to get it into the economy. They have to get people using it. So it's like, well, how do you do that? It's like, well, through government spending. Like, the government has to put the money in people's hands. And it's like, they have so many different levers that they can use to do that, whether it's entitlements or insurance, or like the military industrial complex is a huge lever. They spend so much money to contractors, like work, like those are American companies with American workers. So it's just like these huge contractors or these huge government contracts to the defense, the military industrial complex is like, that's just a vector for how they can inject large amounts of money consistently. So it's just like, for me, until, because I've been thinking about this too, in terms of like the Iran stuff, it's like,
mm-hmm.
I just don't believe anything anybody says, like in the news or what, like, I know you have to print money and you're going to come up with whatever circumstance, you're going to create a situation where you have to print to justify it. So mm-hmm. until conflict is like on the homeland, or you're funding a war not through the printer, I just don't believe you. I think it's just a pretense to print money. You know, like, yes, if another foreign country invaded California and had boots on the on our ground, okay, we could fight. I could trust that maybe that's a justified, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe. Or if it's like, hey, we can't print money. We have to raise the like real money through other means, not the printer. Maybe I would start to consider like, okay, maybe this is a real thing. But no, we are funding the money through the printer. Like, the Fed is the lender of last resort. They will buy any bond that the government makes. So the government says we need to raise money. Here's all these bonds. No one wants to buy the bonds. The Fed always has their back. The Fed will click, and then there you go. Problem solved. And it's like, until that goes away, I cannot trust anything you tell me for why you're fighting. You know, like, the numbers are astronomical. You know, like, you're talking about billions and trillions of dollars, just like this and that. Like, I don't buy it. I don't buy it anymore. So it's like, you know, if we pretended that we had Bitcoin, a Bitcoin standard, how do you go to war? Well, you have to spend real money. You got to you got to tax people their real money. You have to tax them their Bitcoin, and they would have to give it to you, and then you'd have to spend it. And if you spent it poorly or stupidly or for 20 years, you know, if you said, hey, we're going to win and we're going to go, you know, this will be a 12-day war. This will be a 2-week excursion, and then we're going to win and we'll come back home. And then like 20 years later, you couldn't string people along that way. Like, they would push back and say, no, we're not funding this anymore. And it's like, people will say, oh, well, that's bad. How do you respond to emergencies? Well, I think that's a good thing. I think feedback, consequence, when reality hits you back, like that's a good, like pain. Pain is a very good signal. It tells you where you're at in relation to the world. Like, oh, I shouldn't have my hand here. It's a hot stove. Or I'm walking on glass. This is not a place that I should be. Pain is information that tells you where you're at. Like, you need that in a monetary system. You need that. Like, if I want to go fight, I need to be, it's a good check to say, I have to convince other people to give me real money because the idea is good and I'm competent enough that they trust that I will, you know, execute properly. It's just like, when you don't have accountability, when you can just paper over all things, like, there's just, again, this just goes back to this all, it affects how every person relates to everything, other people, the world, themselves. Like, it's just like, I don't know, when people say like, oh, well, Bitcoin's this all like encompassing thing. It's like, yes, it is. Cause it changes how you relate to the entire world and other people. So it's like, it's going to change your life, but in a good way. Like, you are in this fantasy world and we're trying to convince people that, hey, it's a lot better to just step out of that and exist in reality, to treat people as real people and not, you know, just like chattel. I don't know. That's what we are. That's how our the powers that be in the government, in the Fed, the monetary system is treating us like that. And I just had enough with it. So I don't know.
Yeah. No, I was asking because it's an interesting topic. And I think that most people don't see it this way. Because, you know, this question, you make it once, just start realizing about the problem and what is money, what money is, right? But also, I just want to know your opinion. So this war, it's a pretext to print more money. And why now? Have you thought about it? Or why they're doing this now?
I mean, they're just...
Because again, the debt is gone?
Until proven otherwise, that's just what my go-to stance for any justification of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The why now question, I just know that they will continually have to print. I don't even like to think about like the why. I just know they have to. So it doesn't surprise me. The next housing crisis or the next banks or like, I don't know, whatever the next huge crisis is that comes, I'm fully expecting it and ready for it because I know it has to come, if that makes sense. Like, there's a big difference between, you know, you're just living your normal life and then a big storm comes and you have to like react to it. Yeah. And just like when that storm, when you are creating the storm that inevitably reoccurs, it's like, there's a big difference between that, like some natural occurrence that just happens and you have to respond to versus like a systemic, you know, like that's the principle playing itself out. Like, it's to be expected, not to be like, you should not be shocked by it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like,
it kind of, you know, Trump campaigned from the very beginning about how bad Iraq was and how the forever wars are stupid and that like, we're not going to go fight Iran. We're not going to do that. We're getting out of the Middle East. Like, he says all that stuff. And it's just like, I don't blame him as a person specific. Cause it's like, I think he was, you throw that at the system and the system, he just bounced off of it. You know, like he can't even break this.
Yeah.
This system is going to print money. This system is going to do anything it can do to continue its existence. And like, that's why I'm not, my job is not to break it itself. Like, I'm not attacking fiat. I'm just trying to get people to opt out. You know, it's like by stepping away from it, by stop feeding it, by stop going along with it, it'll crumble on its own. You know, it's like, and that's kind of the beautiful thing. Again, it's like this asymmetry thing. I want to, you know, I use this an analogy before, like, when you use economics, you know, when you're using that rake to try to dig that hole, you're kind of you're trying to orange pill people like a miner, where it's just brute force, computational, just blast. That's the only way to do it. It's like, I don't want to orange pill like a miner. I would much rather orange pill like a node and just spend a tiny little bit of energy, validate everything, and I'm good. You know, it's like, that's what I'm asking people to do morally. Ask yourself, how do you justify printing money? How do they justify printing money? You know, recognize that, like, the incoherence, the absurdity of the answer, and then just like use that as like that, okay, reality. It's like, that's how you get people to come out of that fantasy world, you know, the fiat, like by decree, like they're just saying it. They're just wishing, like, hey, wouldn't it be nice if the world was like this and we could just print money and paper over all problems? Like, we'll just print food. It's like, no, you actually have to have food. You have to create food to eat it. It's like, people know that. Like, you intuitively know that you can't print food, but like, we're fine with it printing money. It's like, just, I don't know, getting, it just takes that one little crack in their armor or whatever, in that, like, that, whatever that system is of their thought process, like that one little chink, if you can just get that little bit of truth in there, you know, that can break them open. Like, that's how I was broken open. That little bit of truth got in and started to grow and just, you know, it woke me up, and I'm here to wake other people up too. And I want people to, like, again, I see people talking about Bitcoin and talking about money, and they're trying to advocate for it, and they're trying to tell people Bitcoin's good and it's good for you. And it's just, I just want to arm them with a more effective tool. Like, that's kind of what the book is. It's just like, hey, here's the moral language so you can speak about debasement. You can speak about these things in a way that actually works a lot more efficiently.
Yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. And I think that I was just thinking something that Bob Burnett told me when he came to the podcast, is that he says that that with Bitcoin solves a lot of things. And he says something like, it solves the first order effects that, you know, with fiat, we have slavery, resistance, inequality, poverty, and all these things, right? So I think it's really aligned to what you're saying, that if we actually make aware people that the problem of the current system is that push to these things, I think that with Bitcoin being immoral, money can save all these other things, or at least not be as it is right now, currently, right? Because, because just the values that provide Bitcoin in this first system, I think it's like, it's very difficult to have those kind of issues with the other system. It's, I think, more easier to spread all these broken things. Yeah.
You know, that's 100% right with, like, when you say it solves those first order effects. It's taking, at the most basic, like, again, like, when you do the philosophy and you're going down to the metaphysical,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what more first order you can get, you know? But it changed it, how you as a human being relate to reality itself. Right now, the fiat distorts that relationship. So you're seeing a world that's all crazy. Like, it's always shifting. Like, if the ground underneath your feet is always moving, you're very unsure of how to step, you know? And that's what the money has done, what fiat money has done to us at that first order level. Like, it's just distorted and created so much tension that nobody knows how they relate to the world. And if you don't know how you relate to the world, you don't know how you relate to each other. And it's just like with Bitcoin, when you can stabilize that and communicate, and that relation is just signal. You know, it's like, if you just take the complete noise and take the noise away, and you can just see that signal, then you can actually, you have confidence in walking forward. You can have confidence in building things and planning things. Like, so it's just like, it can only affect everything else up top, because it is so fundamental.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I was thinking that I had discussion this with my partner, and because she works in humanitarian projects, you know, and I'm into Bitcoin. And when we started talking about it, she was like, okay, but she was not into Bitcoin at all. Now she understands it. But I remind her, she told me, but it's economics related, right? And when I started explaining her, no, but, you know, there's more into it. There's these morals. And I explained to her the values that Bitcoin provides just by itself in the system, and how it can improve the life of the people. Because you start thinking that your belief system, it's wrong. So you start questioning everything, right? And just start thinking, okay, if I'm wrong with this, what else is wrong? And with that, your mentality changed and you start thinking on long term, you start thinking about the balance of life, the families, everything, like basically everything. So in that way, she understood it. When I say, listen, no, it provide this. I was like, got it. And I was like, yes, but you see this, but this is the morality and the values that this system brings. So it's more complex than that. We're not trying to people to come into Bitcoin for the money. No, it's actually what we're trying to say is that that exit to that system that had all these problems and come to this system where you can actually provide value, you can make better your life, and you can actually help to others, right? So I think for me, that's the most powerful thing that Bitcoin as well can bring to anyone. Yeah.
Could not agree more. I could not agree more.
Neil, we're going to start wrapping up because we have done more than 1 hour and I don't want to take more of your time. But first, thank you for coming to the podcast. Second, I have one last question, but before that, if there's anything that you need, do you think that I haven't asked and is important to add, let me know.
No, just as a Bitcoiner, I would just ask that you just consider, just think about the morals of it. And to me, it's come to, can I sacrifice the macro for the moral? That's kind of my question I would ask of all Bitcoiners, you know, like if that's what it takes for the normal person to get it, would you do that? Would you stop talking about price? Would you stop talking about trades and all these crazy economic things and charts? It's like, and just speak to the morals. It's like, that's what I'm trying to do, but that's what I ask other people to at least consider.
That's perfect. So yeah, my question goes kind of aligned to that. We have talked a lot about moral and ethics. So my last question is that between all that you have researched, between all that you have learned in your career and with your book, your research and everything, what do you think is the most valuable thing that Bitcoin provided to you personally?
I mean, the most valuable thing that it gives me is my dignity. Like, it lets me be a free and sovereign, individual, a human being. It gives me all my agency back. To me, I don't know anything more valuable than that. The fiat price of it, like, I don't know. When I decided to become like a Bitcoiner, that question of like, okay, well, if it goes to zero, if it dies, like if Bitcoin fails, how would I feel? Would I be okay with it? Committing to it and then losing, you know, because I'm living my life, you know, for Bitcoin on a Bitcoin standard. And if Bitcoin fails, what does that do for me? And it's like, even in that scenario, I'm like, it's worth the shot. We have this chance to pick up this weapon, this monetary tool, Bitcoin, and use it to stop generation. Like, this is a generational cycle of debasement and enslavement. And if it crashes, then at least I can look at my kids and say, yeah, Bitcoin failed, but I tried. Like, I would rather die trying than just go along to get along. But I mean, that's, again, like, I come from the military, though. Like, that's kind of that's already in my blood. Like, my ethos is to, you know, is to fight. Like, this is a fight. Like, it's not just like we're fighting up against an evil system, and the system will fight back. Like, that's like, this isn't going to be all rainbow and sunshine, you know, like moving forward. But I think it's worth it. You know, I think the fight, the effort, the struggle, I think that's, I can't think of a better cause to dedicate myself to. So it's like, I don't know. That's it gives me that back. It gave my life meaning, you know. Now I don't have to just sit back and be this like passive sale just that life happens to. It's like, no, I'm a human being. I'm an agent. I drive myself where I want to go. And just because I'm charging against the winds of fiat, it's like, doesn't matter. I don't know.
Yeah. By the way,
I don't know if that is the question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just thinking that you were in the military, and do you read Jason Lurie's book?
I have not. I know generally about his thesis.
Okay.
Kind of like generally about soft war thesis, but I have not read it.
Okay. Well, that's for another time. All right, Neil, thank you very much for spending time with us and to share about your book a lot. And we have learned a lot. Me, myself, and I know the audience will learn much more. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
No, thanks to you. All right, guys, that's it for today, but see you next week. Ciao.